Max faded for a few moments and then reappeared in an elegant red suit with blouse, jacket, and skirt.
"Much better," she said happily. "I hate to look mundane when I'm on the job."
"Now that you're in a good mood, I would like you to produce data on a subject. What can you tell me about Cerberus, the three-headed dog?"
"From Greek mythology," Max came back instantly. "Cerberus was the three-headed grotesque dog who guarded the gates of Hades and prevented the dead souls from escaping from the underworld. The three heads represented the past, present, and future. What the serpent tail signified is not known to me."
"What can you tell me about the Cerberus Corporation?" Pitt asked.
"I will let you know after I've entered their network and those of the companies who do business with them. Since their interests are international, various world governments also must have extensive files on them."
Pitt looked at Jaeger suspiciously. "Since when is hacking into corporate networks legal?" Jaeger's expression took on that of a canny fox. "Once I give Max a command to search, far be it from me to interfere with her methods." The old aircraft hangar, built in the 1930s, stood off in one corner of Ronald Reagan International Airport. The corrugated metal walls and roof were coated with rust. Its few windows were boarded over, and the door to what once was the office was weather-worn, with fading and peeling paint. Pitt parked the Pneuma Jeep in the weeds outside the hangar and paused at the entrance door. He glanced at the security camera atop a wooden pole on the other side of the road to see that it had stopped its swivel and was aimed directly at him. Then he punched a sequence of numbers, waited for a series of clicks inside the hangar, and turned the brass latch. Inside, set off by the bright overhead lights, white walls and epoxy floor, were three rows of beautifully restored classic automobiles. Sitting incongruously at the end of one row was a 1936 Ford hot rod. On one side of the hangar sat a World War II German jet fighter and a 1929 tri-motor transport. Beyond was a turn-of-the-century railroad Pullman car, an odd-looking sailboat mounted on a rubber raft, and a bathtub with an outboard motor attached on one end. The collection of automotive mechanical masterpieces of art represented events in Pitt's life. He took a brief tour, as he always did, after returning home after an expedition. Then he climbed the antique iron circular staircase to his apartment that was perched above the main floor against the hangar's far wall. The interior of his apartment was just as unique as the eclectic transportation collection below. Here there were all sorts of nautical antiques. The 1,100 square feet of living space was crowded with objects from old ships sunk or scrapped. There was a large wooden-spoked helm from an ancient clipper ship, a compass binnacle from an old Orient tramp steamer, ship's bells, brass and copper divers' helmets. The furniture was an assemblage of antique pieces that came from ships that had sailed the seas in the 19th century. After taking a shower and shaving, Pitt made reservations at a small French restaurant that was only a mile from the hangar. He could have called Lauren, but decided he wished to dine alone. Then he took the slip of paper with Kelly's phone number on it and called her.
"I'm up to my ears in charity work," she told him. "I'm chairman of the local handicapped children's organization. We're putting on our annual flying roundup, and I'm chairman of the event."
"I hate to sound stupid, but what is a flying roundup?" Kelly laughed.
"It's like an air show. People fly in old vintage airplanes and take the kids for rides in them."
"You have your work cut out for you."
"Tell me about it," she said. "The man who owned a 63-year-old Douglas DC-3 had a problem with the landing gear and can't make the show."
Pitt walked out onto the balcony of his apartment with the portable phone and gazed at the classics below. "I think I can help you out. I know somebody who is an easy touch for beautiful women and handicapped kids." At 11 the next morning, Pitt entered the Pneuma conference room.
Sandecker and Rudy Gunn were already seated at the long conference table that had been constructed from planking salvaged from a schooner sunk in Lake Erie in 1882. Sandecker made the introductions as two other men rose to greet him.
"Dirk, I believe you know these gentlemen."
A tall blond man with a mustache and light blue eyes shook Pitt's hand. "Good to see you, Dirk. It's been, what, 2 years?" Pitt pressed the hand of Wilbur Hill, a director with the CIA. "Closer to 3. Charles Davis, the special assistant to the director of the FBI, stepped forward. At 6'6", he was by far the tallest man in the room. He always reminded Pitt of a dog with sad, droopy eyes in search of his food dish. "We last met when we worked together on that Chinese immigration case."
"I remember it well," Pitt replied cordially.
Yeager began by passing around folders with copies of photos of the sunken Emerald Dolphin. "While you gentlemen study these, I'll run the VCR." A huge three-sided monitor dropped from a hidden recess in the ceiling. Yeager pressed buttons on a remote control, and the images taken by the video cameras of the sea sleuth began to sweep in three dimensions across a stage in front of the screens. Pitt gave a narration as the submersible moved along the hull of the sunken cruise liner. "At first we believed she shattered upon impact with the bottom, but if you study the way the gaps in the hull are torn outward, it appears obvious that a series of explosions blew out the hull beneath the waterline while the derelict was under tow."